And that we cannot allow. Greg heard the words as his fingers strained toward Nur al-Allah's sandals. Puppet Man added his strength, but it was as if Nur al-Allah stood atop a mountain and Greg were reaching vainly up from the foot. Beads of sweat stood out on his forehead. Saeed glanced down scornfully, not even deigning to kick Greg's hand away from his master. Nur al-Allah laughed at Takyan's words.
You challenge me, you who do not believe in Allah? I can feel you, Dr. Takyan. I can feel your power prying at my mind. You believe that my mind can be broken the way you might break the mind of one of your companions. That's not so. Allah protects me and Allah will punish those who attack him.
Yet even as he spoke, Greg saw the strain on Nur al-Allah's face. His radiance seemed to dim and the barriers holding Greg loosened. Whatever the prophet's boast, Takyan's mental attack was getting through. Greg felt a quick hope. At that moment, with Nur al-Allah's attention on Takyan, Greg managed to touch the shimmering flesh of the prophet's foot. The emerald radiance burned hot. He ignored it. Puppet Man shouted in triumph. And then quickly recoiled. Nur al-Allah was there. He was aware, and Greg could sense Takyan's presence as well. Too dangerous, Puppet Man cried. He knows, he knows! From behind, there was a thud and a strangled cry, and Greg looked back over his shoulder at the doctor. One of the guards had come up behind Takyan, clubbing the alien on the head with the butt of his Uzi. Takyan was on his knees, his hands covering his head, moaning. He struggled to rise, but the guard struck him down, brutally. Takyan lay unconscious on the tiled mosaic of the floor, his breathing labored. Nur al-Allah laughed. He looked down at Greg, whose hands still reached futilely toward the foot of the prophet.
There, you see, I am protected by Allah, by my people. What about you, Senator Hartman? You with Kahina's strings? Do you still want me now? Perhaps I should show you the strings of Allah and make you dance for his pleasure. Kahina said you are a danger, and Saeed wants you killed, so perhaps you should be the first sacrifice. How would your people react if they saw you confess your crimes and then, begging Allah's forgiveness, kill yourself? Would that be effective, do you think?
Nur al-Allah pointed a finger at Greg.
Yes, he said. I think it would.
Puppet Man yammered in fear.
Yes, I think it would.
Misha listened to her brother's words with unease. Everything he had done was a slap in her face. The flaunting of the Stone Jokers, the attack on Takyan, his haughty threats now. Najib betrayed her with every word. Najib had used her and lied to her, he and Saeed. He'd let her go to Damascus, thinking that she was representing them, that if she brought the Americans, there might be a chance of some agreement. But Najib hadn't cared. He hadn't listened to her warnings that he overreached himself. A slow festering rose inside her, leeching away her faith. Allah, I believe in your voice within Najib, but now he shows his own second face. Is it yours as well? The doubt diluted the magic of Najib's voice, and she dared to speak and interrupt him. You move too fast, Najib, she hissed. Don't destroy us with your pride. His glowing face contorted, his speech halting in mid-sentence.
I am the prophet, he snapped. Not you.
Then at least listen to me, who sees our future. This is a mistake, Najib. This way leads away from Allah.
Be silent,
he roared, and his fist lashed out. A red-hued dizziness blinded her. In that moment, with Najib's voice dulled by pain, something in her mind gave way, some barrier that had been holding back all the venom. This fury was cold and deadly, poisonous with every insult and abuse Najib had given her over the years, laced with frustration and denial and subjugation. Najib had turned away from her, expecting her obedience. He resumed his tirade, the power of the voice coiling out over the crowd once more. It could not touch her, not through what spilled from the bitter pool. She saw the knife in his sash and knew what she had to do. The compulsion was too great for her to resist. She leapt at Najib, screaming wordlessly.
Sarah saw Nur al-Allah point his glowing finger toward Greg. Yet, in following that gesture, her attention was snagged by Kahina. Sarah frowned even under the spell of Nur al-Allah's words, for Kahina was trembling. She stared at her brother, and there was nothing in her eyes but acid. She shouted something to him in Arabic, and he swung around to her, still pulsing with flaring power. They exchanged words. He struck her. It was as if that blow had driven her into a divine madness. Kahina leapt at Nur al-Allah like some predatory cat, screaming as she clawed at him with bare hands. Dark rivulets of blood dimmed the moon of his face. She tugged at the long, curved knife in his sash, pulling it from the bejeweled scabbard. In the same motion, she slashed across his throat with the keen edge. Nur al-Allah clutched at his neck, blood pouring between his fingers as a strangled, wet gasping came from him. He toppled backward. For a moment, the horror held everyone in suspension. Then the room erupted into shouts. Kahina was standing in shock above Nur al-Allah, the knife dangling from white fingers. Saeed bellowed in disbelief, swinging a huge arm that sent Kahina tumbling to the floor. Saeed took a clumsy step forward. Sarah realized with a start that the giant was a cripple. Two of the guards seized Kahina, dragging her to her feet as she struggled. Other men crouched beside the stricken Nur al-Allah, trying to stanch the flow of blood. Saeed had reached Kahina. He picked up the dagger she'd dropped, staring at the dark stains on it. He wailed, his eyes raised to heaven, and then drew the blade back to stab her. But he moaned, the blade still raised. He sagged, his knees buckling as if some great weight were pressing down on him from above, crushing him. Saeed screamed in agony, dropping the weapon. His massive body collapsed in on itself, the skeleton no longer able to support the flesh. Everyone heard the dry, sickening crack of snapping bones. Sarah glanced around and saw Hiram sweating, his right fist squeezing into a white-knuckled fist. Saeed whimpered, a shapeless mass on the tiles. The guards let go of Kahina in confusion. Kahina ran. One of the guards brought his Uzi to bear, but he was slammed against the wall by Mordecai Jones. Jack Braun, glowing golden, picked up another of the Nur al-Allah's guards and tossed him bodily across the room. Peregrine, her feathers molting, was unable to take to the air. Still, she slipped on her taloned gloves and slashed at a guard. Billy Ray, with an exultant whoop, spun and kicked the knees of the gunman alongside him. Kahina ducked through an archway and was gone. Sarah found Greg in the confusion. He was safe. A wave of relief flooded through her. She began to run toward him, and the relief turned frigid. There was no more fright on his face. No concern at all. He seemed calm. He almost seemed to smile. Sarah gaped. She felt nothing but a yawning emptiness. "No," she whispered to herself. "What he would do to me, he would also do to you." "No," she insisted. "That can't be."
Nur al-Allah had pointed his accusing finger at Greg, and Greg had known that his only hope lay in the bitterness within Kahina. Nur al-Allah was beyond his control, he knew now, but Kahina was his. Greg's rape of her mind was brutal and ruthless. He'd stripped everything from her but that underlying hate, letting it flood and swell. It had worked beyond his expectations. But he'd wanted Kahina dead. He'd wanted her silenced. It must have been Hiram that had stopped Saeed. too chivalrous to give Kahina to Islamic justice, and strangely brutal with his power. Greg berated himself for not having foreseen that. He could have controlled Hiram, long a puppet, even with the strange hues he'd seen in the man lately. Now the moment was gone. The spell broken with the loss of Nur al-Ala's voice, Greg let himself touch Hiram's mind and saw that faint, odd coloring there again. He had no time to muse on it. People were shouting, an oozy chatter deafening. In the midst of chaos, Greg felt Sarah. He swung about to find her staring at him. Emotions were shifting wildly inside her. Her love was tattered, stretched thin under swelling ochre suspicion. "Sarah!" he called, and her gaze slid sharply away, looking at the press of people around Nur al-Ala. There was fighting all around him. He thought he saw Billy, glee on his face, dive bodily at a guard. "Let me have Sarah, or you've lost her," Puppet Man sounded oddly sad. "There's nothing you can say to undo the damage. She's all you can salvage from this. Give her to me, or she's gone too." "No, she can't know. It's not possible that she knows." Greg protested, but he knew that he was wrong. He could see the damage in her mind. No lie could repair that. Grieving, he entered her mind and caressed the torn azure fragment of her affection. Greg watched as slowly, carefully, Puppet Man buried her distrust under bright and soft ribbons of false love. He hugged her quickly. "Come on," he said gruffly. "We're leaving." Out in the room, Billy Ray stood over an unconscious guard. His strident voice ordered his security people into position. "Move! You, get the doctor! Senator Hartman, now! Let's get out of here!" There was still some resistance on the floor, but Nur al-Ala's people were in shock. Most knelt around Nur al-Ala's prone body. The prophet was still alive. Greg could sense his fright, his pain. Greg wanted Nur al-Ala dead too, but there was no opportunity for that. Gunfire erupted near Greg. Brawn, glowing intensely now, stepped in front of the hidden gunman. They could hear the whine of the slugs ricocheting from his body. Greg grunted in shock even as Brawn tore the weapon away from the man. A lancing fire slammed into his shoulder, the impact staggering him. "Greg!" he heard Sarah cry. On his knees, he groaned. He pulled his hand away from his shoulder and saw his fingers bright with blood. The room spun around him. Puppet Man cowered. "Joanne, get him out! The senator's hit!" Billy Ray moved Sarah aside and crouched beside Greg. He carefully stripped the blood-stained jacket from the senator to examine the wound. Greg could feel relief flood through the man. "You'll be okay. A good long graze, that's all. Let me give you a hand." "I can make it," he grated through clenched teeth, struggling to his feet. Sarah took his good arm, helping him up. He gulped air. There was violence all around him, and Puppet Man was too dazed to even feed. He forced himself to think, to ignore the throbbing pain. "Billy, go on. Get the others." There was little to do. The remainder of Nur al-Ala's people were tending to their prophet. Peregrine had slipped outside. Jones and Brawn were shepherding lions and the other dignitaries. Hiram had turned Tachyon nearly weightless and was assisting him outside as the doctor shook his head groggily. No one resisted their retreat. Sarah let Greg lean against her as they fled. As they tumbled into seats in the helicopter, she hugged him softly. "I'm glad you're safe," she whispered. She took his hand as the chopper's blades tore the night air. It was as if Greg grasped a doll's wooden hand. It meant nothing. Nothing at all.
From the Journal of Xavier Desmond. February the 7th. Kabul, Afghanistan. I'm in a good deal of pain today. Most of the delegates have gone on a day trip to various historic sites, but I elected to stay at the hotel once again. Our tour? What can I say? Syria has made headlines around the world. Our press contingent has doubled in size, all of them eager to get the inside story of what happened out in the desert. For once, I am not unhappy to have been excluded. Perry has told me what it was like. Syria has touched all of us, myself included. Not all of my pain is caused by the cancer. There are times when I grow profoundly weary, looking back over my life and wondering whether I have done any good at all, or if all my life's work has been for nothing. I have tried to speak out on behalf of my people to appeal to reason and decency and the common humanity that unites us all. And I have always been convinced that quiet strength, perseverance, and nonviolence would get us further in the long run. Syria makes me wonder. How do you reason with a man like the Nur al-Allah? Compromise with him, talk to him. How do you appeal to his humanity when he does not consider you human at all? If there is a God, I pray that he forgives me, but I find myself wishing they had killed the Nur. Hiram has left the tour, albeit temporarily. He promises to rejoin us in India, but by now he's back in New York City after jetting from Damascus to Rome and then catching a Concorde back to America. He told us that an emergency had arisen at Aces High that demanded his personal attention, but I suspect the truth is that Syria shook him more than he cared to admit. The rumor has swept around the plane that Hiram lost control in the desert, that he hit General Saeed with far more weight than was necessary to stop him. Billy Ray, of course, doesn't think Hiram went far enough. If it'd been me, I would have piled it on till he was just a brown and red stain on the floor, he told me. Worcester himself refused to talk about it and insisted that he was taking this brief leave of us simply because he was sick unto death of stuffed grape leaves. But even as he made the joke, I noticed beads of sweat on his broad, bald forehead and a slight tremor in his hand. I hope a short respite restores him. The more we have traveled together, the more I've come to respect Hiram Worcester. If clouds do indeed have a silver lining, however, then perhaps one good did come out of the monstrous incident in Syria. Greg Hartman's stature seems to have been vastly enhanced by his near brush with death. For a decade now, his political fortunes have been haunted by the specter of the great Jokertown riot in 1976, when he lost his head in public. To me, his reaction was only human. He had just witnessed a woman being torn to pieces by a mob, after all. But presidential candidates are not allowed to weep or grieve or rage like the rest of us, as Muskie proved in 72 and Hartman confirmed in 76. Syria may finally have put that tragic incident to rest. Everyone who was there agrees that Hartman's behavior was exemplary. He was firm, cool-headed, courageous, a pillar of strength in the face of the Nur's barbarous threats. Every paper in America has run the AP photo that was taken as they pulled out. Hiram helping Tachyon into the helicopter in the background, while in the foreground, Senator Hartman waited, his face streaked with dust, yet still grim and strong, his blood soaking through the sleeve of his white shirt. Greg still claims that he's not going to be a presidential candidate in 1988. And indeed, all the polls show that Gary Hart has an overwhelming lead for the Democratic nomination. But Syria and the photograph will surely do wonders for his name recognition and his standing. I find myself desperately hoping that he will reconsider. I have nothing against Gary Hart, but Greg Hartman is something special. And perhaps for those of us touched by the wild card, he is our last best hope. If Hartman fails, all my hopes fail with him. And then, what choice will we have but to turn to the black dog? I suppose I should write something about Afghanistan, but there's little to record. I don't have the strength to see what sights Kabul has to offer, The Soviets are much in evidence here, but they're being very correct and courteous. The war is being kept at arm's length for the duration of our short stopover. Two Afghan jokers have been produced for our approval, both of whom swear, through Soviet interpreters, that a joker's life is idyllic here. Somehow I'm not convinced. If I understand correctly, they are the only two jokers in all of Afghanistan. The stack deck flew directly from Baghdad to Kabul. Iran was out of the question. The Ayatollah shares many of the Nur's views on wildcards, and he rules his nation in name as well as fact, so even the UN could not secure us permission to land. At least the Ayatollah makes no distinctions between aces and jokers. We are all the demon children of the great Satan, according to him. Obviously, he's not forgotten Jimmy Carter's ill-fated attempt to free the hostages when a half-dozen government aces were sent in on a secret mission that turned into a horrid botch. The rumor is that Carnifex was one of the aces involved, but Billy Ray emphatically denies it. If I'd been along, we would have gotten our people out and kicked the old man's ass for good measure, he says. His colleague from Justice, Lady Black, just pulls her black cloak more tightly about herself and smiles enigmatically. Mistral's father, Cyclone, has often been linked to that doomed mission as well, but it's not something she'll talk about. Tomorrow morning, we'll fly over the Khyber Pass and cross into India, a different world entirely. A whole, sprawling subcontinent with the largest Joker population anywhere outside the United States. February the 12th, Calcutta. India is as strange and fabulous a land as any we have seen on this trip. If indeed it is correct to call it a land at all. It seems more like 100 lands in one. I find it hard to connect the Himalayas and the palaces of the Mughals to the slums of Calcutta and Bengali jungles. The Indians themselves live in a dozen different worlds, from the aging Britishers who try to pretend that the Viceroy still rules in their little enclaves of the Raj, to the Maharajas and Nawabs who are kings in all but name, to the beggars on the streets of this sprawling, filthy city. There is so much of India. In Calcutta, you see jokers on the streets everywhere you go. They are as common as beggars, naked children, and corpses, and too frequently one and the same. In this quasi-nation of Hindu and Muslim and Sikh, the vast majority of jokers seem to be Hindu, but given Islam's attitudes, that can hardly be a surprise. The Orthodox Hindu has invented a new caste for the Joker, far below even the untouchable, but at least they're allowed to live. Interestingly enough, we have found no Joker towns in India. This culture is sharply divided along racial and ethnic grounds, and the enmities run very deep, as was clearly shown in the Calcutta wildcard riots of 1947, and the wholesale nationwide carnage that accompanied the partition of the subcontinent that same year. Despite that, today you find Hindu and Muslim and Sikh living side by side on the same street, and jokers and gnats and even a few pathetic deuces sharing the same hideous slums. It does not seem to have made them love each other anymore, alas. India also boasts a number of native aces, including a few of considerable power. Digger is having a grand time dashing about the country, interviewing them all, or as many as will consent to meet with him. Radha O'Reilly, on the other hand, is obviously very unhappy here. She is Indian royalty herself, it appears, at least on her mother's side. Her father was some sort of Irish adventurer. Her people practice a variety of Hinduism built around Ganesh, the elephant god, and the black mother Kali, and to them, her wildcard ability makes her the destined bride of Ganesh, or something along those lines. At any rate, she seems firmly convinced that she is in imminent danger of being kidnapped and forcibly returned to her homeland. So, except for the official receptions in New Delhi and Bombay, she has remained closely closeted in the various hotels with Carnifex, Lady Black, and the rest of our security close at hand. I believe she will be very happy to leave India once again. Dr. Tachyon, Peregrine, Mistral, Fantasy, Troll, and the Harlem Hammer have just returned from a tiger hunt in the Bengal. Their host was one of the Indian aces, a Maharaja blessed with a form of the Midas touch. I understand that the gold he creates is inherently unstable and reverts to its original state within 24 hours, although the process of transmutation is still sufficient to kill any living thing he touches. Still, his palace is reputed to be quite a spectacular place. He solved the traditional mythic dilemma by having his servants feed him. Tachyon returned from the expedition in as good a spirit as I've seen him since Syria, wearing a golden Nehru jacket and matching turban, fastened by a ruby the size of my thumb. The Maharaja was lavish with his gifts, it seems. Even the prospect of the jacket and turban reverting to common cloth in a few hours does not seem to have dampened our alien's enthusiasm for the day's activities. The glittering pageant of the hunt, the splendors of the palace, and the Maharaja's harem all seem to have reminded Tak of the pleasures and prerogatives he once enjoyed as a prince of the Ilkazam on his home world. He admitted that even on Takus, there was no sight to compare to the end of the hunt, when the man-eater had been brought to bay, and the Maharaja calmly approached it, removed one golden glove, and transmuted the huge beast to solid gold with a touch. While our aces were accepting their presents of fairy gold and hunting tigers, I spent the day in humbler pursuits, in the unexpected company of Jack Braun, who was invited to the hunt with the others, but declined. Instead, Braun and I made our way across Calcutta to visit the monument the Indians erected to Earl Sanderson on the site where he saved Mahatma Gandhi from assassination. The memorial resembles a Hindu temple, and the statue inside looks more like some minor Indian deity than an American black who played football for Rutgers, but still. Sanderson has indeed become some sort of god to these people. Various offerings left by worshippers were strewn about the feet of his statue. It was very crowded, and we had to wait for a long time before we were admitted. The Mahatma is still universally revered in India, and some of his popularity seems to have rubbed off on the memory of the American ace who stepped between him and an assassin's bullet. Braun said very little when we were inside, just stared up at the statue, as if somehow willing it to come to life. It was a moving visit, but not entirely a comfortable one. My obvious deformity drew hard looks from some of the higher caste Hindus in the press of the people, and whenever someone brushed against Braun too tightly, as happened frequently among such a tightly packed mass of people, his biological force field would begin to shimmer, surrounding him with a ghostly golden glow. I'm afraid my nervousness got the better of me, and I interrupted Braun's reveries and got us out of there hastily. Perhaps I overreacted, but if even one person in that crowd had realized who Jack Braun was, it might have triggered a vastly ugly scene. Braun was very moody and quiet on the way back to our hotel. Gandhi is a personal hero of mine, and for all my mixed feelings about aces, I must admit that I am grateful to Earl Sanderson for the intervention that saved Gandhi's life. For the great prophet of nonviolence to die by an assassin's bullet would have been too grotesque, and I think India would have torn itself apart in the wake of such a death, in a fratricidal bloodbath the likes of which the world has never seen. If Gandhi had not lived to lead the reunification of the subcontinent after the death of Jinnah in 1948, would that strange two-headed nation called Pakistan actually have endured? Would the All India Congress have displaced all the petty rulers and absorbed their domains as it threatened to do? The very shape of this decentralized, endlessly diverse patchwork country is an expression of the Mahatma's dreams. I find it inconceivable to imagine what course Indian history might have taken without him. So in that respect, at least, the Four Aces left a real mark on the world and perhaps demonstrated that one determined man can indeed change the course of history for the better. I pointed all this out to Jack Braun on our ride home when he seemed so withdrawn. I'm afraid it did not help much. He listened to me patiently, and when I was finished, he said, "It was Earl who saved him, not me," and lapsed back into silence. True to his promise, Hiram Worcester returned to the tour today via Concorde from London. His brief sojourn in New York seems to have done him a world of good. His old ebullience was back, and he promptly convinced Tachyon, Mordecai Jones, and Fantasy to join him on an expedition to find the hottest vindaloo in Calcutta. He pressed Peregrine to join the foraging party as well, but the thought seemed to make her turn green. Tomorrow morning, Father Squid, Troll, and I will visit the Ganges, where, legend has it, a joker can bathe in the sacred waters and be cured of his afflictions. Our guides tell us there are hundreds of documented cases, but I am frankly dubious. Although Father Squid insists that there have been miraculous joker cures in Lourdes as well. Perhaps I shall succumb and leap into the sacred waters after all. A man dying of cancer can ill afford the luxury of skepticism, I suppose. Chrysalis was invited to join us, but declined. These days, she seems most comfortable in the hotel bars, drinking amaretto and playing endless games of solitaire. She has become quite friendly with two of our reporters, Sarah Morgenstern and the ubiquitous Digger Downs. And I've even heard talk that she and Digger are sleeping together. Back from the Ganges, I must make my confession. I took off my shoe and sock, rolled up my pants legs, and put my foot in the sacred waters. Afterward, I was still a joker, alas. A joker with a wet foot. The sacred waters are filthy, by the way, and while I was fishing for my miracle, someone stole my shoe.
The Teardrop of India by Walton Simons. Read for you by Sanjit De Silva. The people of Colombo had been waiting for the apes since early morning, and the police were having trouble keeping them away from the docks. A few were getting past the wooden barricades, only to be quickly caught and hustled into the bright yellow police vans. Some sat on parked cars. Others had children perched on their shoulders. Most were content to stand behind the cordons, craning their necks for a look at what the local press called the Great American Monster. Two massive cranes lifted the giant ape slowly off the barge. It hung bound and limp, dark fur poking out from inside the steel mesh. The only indication of life was the slow rising and falling of its 15-foot-wide chest. There was a grinding squeal as the cranes pivoted together, swinging the ape sideways until it was over the freshly painted green railway car. The flat car groaned as the ape settled onto its broad steel bed. There was scattered cheering and clapping from the crowd. It was the same as the vision he'd had only a few months ago. The crowd, the calm sea and clear sky, the sweat on the back of his neck, all the same. The visions never lied. He knew exactly what would happen for the next 15 minutes or so. After that, he could go back to living again. He adjusted the collar of his Nehru shirt and flashed his government ID card to the policeman nearest him. The officer nodded and stepped out of his way. He was a special assistant to the Secretary of the Interior, which gave him a particularly wide range of responsibilities. Sometimes what he did was little more than nursemaid rich visiting foreigners, but it was preferable to the 20-plus years it spent in embassies overseas. There was a group of 20 or 30 Americans around the train. Most wore light gray security uniforms and were busy chaining the beast down to the railway car. They kept an eye on the ape while going about their business, but didn't act afraid. A tall man in a Hawaiian print shirt and plaid Bermuda shorts was standing well away, talking to a girl in a light blue cotton sundress. They were both wearing red and black King Pongo visors. He walked over to the tall man and tapped him on the shoulder. "Not now." The man didn't even bother to turn and look at him. "Mr. Danforth?" He tapped him on the shoulder again, harder. "Welcome to Sri Lanka. I am G.C. Jayawardena. You telephoned me last month about your film?" Jayawardena spoke English, Sinhalese, Tamil, and Dutch. His position in the government required it. The film producer turned, his face blank. "Jayawardena? Oh, right, the government guy. Nice to meet you." Danforth grabbed his hand and pumped it a few times. "We're real busy right now. Guess you can see that." "Of course. If it's not too much trouble, I'd like to ride along while you're transporting the ape." Jayawardena could not help but be impressed with its size. The monster was even taller than the 40-foot Okanna Buddha. "It seems much larger when you see it up close." "No joke. But it'll be worth all the blood, sweat, and tears it took to get it here when the film comes out." He jerked his thumb toward the monster. "That baby is great pub." Jayawardena put his hand over his mouth, trying to hide his puzzled expression. "Publicity," Danforth smiled. "Have to watch the industry slang, I guess." "Sure, GC, you can ride in the VIP car with us. It's the one in front of our hairy friend." "Thank you." The giant ape exhaled, stirring the dust and dirt by its open mouth into a small cloud. "Great pub," said Jayawardena. The rhythmic clacking of the train's wheels on the old railway track relaxed him. Jayawardena had ridden the island trains on countless trips in the 40-odd years since he'd boarded one for the first time as a boy. The girl in the blue dress, who'd finally introduced herself as Paula Curtis, was staring out the window at the terraced tea fields. Danforth was working over a map with a red felt-tip pen. "Okay," he said, putting the handle end of the pen to his lips. "We take the train to the end of the line, which is around the headwaters of the Kaluganga." He flattened the map onto his knees and pointed to the spot with his pen. "Now that puts us at the edge of the Udawalawe National Park, and Roger has supposedly scouted out some great locations for us there, right?" "Right," Paula answered, "if you trust Roger." "He's the director, my dear, we have to trust him. Too bad we couldn't afford somebody decent, but the effects are going to take up most of the budget." A steward walked over to them, carrying a tray with plates of curried rice and string hoppers, small, steamed strands of rice flour dough. Jayawardena took a plate and smiled. "Istuti," he said, thanking the young steward. The boy had a round face and broad nose, obviously Sinhalese like himself. Paula turned from the window long enough to take a plate. Danforth waved the boy away. "I'm not sure I understand." Jayawardena took a mouthful of the rice, chewed briefly, and swallowed. There was too little cinnamon in the curry for his taste. "Why spend money on special effects when you have a 50-foot ape?" "Like I said earlier, the monster's great pub. But it would be hell trying to get the thing to perform on cue, not to mention being prohibitively dangerous to everyone around him. Oh, we may use him in a couple of shots, and definitely for sound effects, but most of the stuff will be done with miniatures." Danforth grabbed a fingerful of rice from Paula's plate and dropped it into his mouth, then shrugged. "Then when the movie opens, the critics will say they can't tell the real ape from the model, and people take that as a challenge, see? Figure they can be the one to spot it. It sells tickets. Surely the publicity value is less than the money it took to get the beast from the city of New York and bring it halfway around the world?" Jayawardena dabbed at the corner of his mouth with a cloth napkin. Danforth looked up, grinning. "Actually, we got the ape for nothing. See, it gets loose every now and then and starts tearing things up. The city is up to its ass in lawsuits every time that happens. If it's not in New York, it can't do any damage. They almost paid us to take the thing off their hands. Of course, we have to make sure nothing happens to it, or the zoo would lose one of its main attractions. That's what those boys in gray are for. And if the ape escapes here, your film company will be liable. Jai Wardner took another bite. We've got it doped up all the time, and frankly doesn't seem much interested in anything. Except blonde women, Paula pointed to her short brown hair. Lucky for me. She looked back out the window. What's that mountain?
Sripada, Adam's Peak. There is a footprint at the top said to be made by the Buddha himself. It is a very holy place.
Jai Wardner made the pilgrimage to the top every year. He planned to do so in the near future, as soon as his schedule allowed it. This time with hopes of cleansing himself spiritually so that there were no more visions.
No kidding. Paula elbowed Danforth. We gonna have time to do any sightseeing?
We'll see, Danforth said, reaching over for more rice. Jai Wardener set his plate down.
Excuse me.
He got up and walked to the rear of the car, slid the door open, and stepped out onto the platform. The giant ape's head was only about 12 feet from where he stood. Its eyes fluttered, then stared up at the rounded top of Adam's Peak. The ape opened its mouth, lips pulled back, revealing the huge yellow-white teeth. There was a rumble, louder than the train engine, from the back of the monster's throat.
It's waking up!
He yelled at the security men riding at the back of the flat car. They walked forward carefully, steadying themselves on the car's side railing, avoiding the ape's manacled hands. One watched the monster, rifle centered on its head. The other changed the plastic bottle hooked up to the IV in the ape's arm.
Thanks!
One of the guards waved at Jaiwardena.
It'll be okay now. This stuff will put him out for hours.
The ape twisted its head and looked directly at him, then turned back to Adam's Peak. It sighed and closed its eyes. There was something in the monster's brown eyes that he couldn't identify. He paused, then went back into the car. The curry aftertaste was sour in the back of his throat. They reached the camp at dusk. Actually, it was more of a hastily thrown-together city of tents and portable buildings. There was less activity than Jai Warden had expected. Most of the crew sat around talking or playing cards. Only the zoo security people were busy, carefully unloading the ape onto a broadbed truck. It was still unconscious from the drug. Danforth told Paula to introduce Jai Wardner around. The director, Roger Winters, was busy making changes in the shooting script. He wore a Frank S. Buck outfit, complete with pith helmet to hide his thinning hair. Paula guided Jai Wardner away from the director.
You wouldn't like him, she said. Nobody does. At least, nobody I know. But he can bring them in on schedule. Here's somebody you'll be more interested in. You're not married, are you?
Widowed.
Oh, sorry.
She waved at a blonde woman sitting on the bare wooden steps of the camp's main building. The woman wore a black and red King Pongo t-shirt, tight blue jeans, and leather walking boots.
Hi, Paula, said the blonde, tossing her hair. Who's your friend?
Robin Sims. Meet Mr. G.C. Jai Wardner, Paula said.
Robin extended her hand. Jai Wardner lightly shook it.
Nice to meet you, Miss Sims. Jai Wardner bowed, embarrassingly aware of the tightness of his shirt across his oversized stomach.
He was flattered to be in the company of the only two women he'd seen in the camp. They were both attractive in a foreign way. He wiped the sweat from his brow and wondered how they would look in saris.
Look, I have to go settle Danforth in. Why don't you two entertain each other for a while?
Paula was walking away before either of them had time to answer.
Your name is Jai Wardener. Any relation to President Junius Jai Wardener?
No, it's a common name.
How do you like it here?
He sat down next to her. The steps were uncomfortably hot.
Well, I've only been here a few days, but it's a beautiful place.
A bit too hot for my taste, but I'm from North Dakota. He nodded.
We have every kind of beauty imaginable here. Beaches, mountains, jungle, cities. Something for everyone. Except cold weather, of course.
There was a pause.
So,
Robin slapped her hands on her thighs.
What is it you do that your government decided to stick you out here with us?
I'm a diplomat of sorts. My job is to make foreign visitors happy here. Or at least to try.
We like to maintain a reputation as a friendly country. Well, I sure haven't seen anything to contradict that. The people I've met practically kill you with kindness. She pointed to the line of trees at the edge of the camp. The animals are something again, though. You know what they found this morning? He shrugged. A cobra. Right over there. Oofta. That's something that you definitely don't get in North Dakota. She shuddered. Most animals I can handle, but snakes? She made a face. Nature is complete and harmonious here, he smiled. But I must be boring you. No, not really. You're certainly more interesting than Roger or the gaffers and grips. How long will you be here? I mean, with the film company. Off and on for your entire stay, although I'll be going back to Colombo tomorrow for a few days. Dr. Tachyon, the alien, and a large party from your country will be arriving here then, to study the effect of the virus in my country. A shiver eased up his spine. You're a busy little bee, aren't you? She looked up. The light was beginning to dim around the swaying treetops. I'm gonna go get some sleep. You might want to do the same. Paula will show you where. She knows everything. Danforth wouldn't ever finish a film without her. Jaiwathana watched her walk away, sighing at the memory of pleasure he thought best forgotten, then got up and headed in the direction Paula had gone. He would need sleep to be fresh for the trip back tomorrow. But sleep never came easily to him, and he was afraid to dream. He'd learned to be afraid. He woke up biting his right hand hard enough to draw blood. His breathing was ragged and his nightshirt was bathed in sweat. The world around him shimmered and then came into focus. Another vision, snatched from the future. They were happening more and more often in spite of his prayers and meditation. It was only a small comfort that this one wasn't about him, not directly anyway. He pulled on his pants and shoes, unzipped his tent, and stepped outside. Jaiwathana walked quietly toward the truck where the ape was chained. Two men were on guard. One was leaning against the cab. The other was sitting with his back to one of the huge mud-covered tires. Both had rifles and lit cigarettes. They were speaking softly to each other. What's up? Asked the man by the cab as Jaiwathana approached. He didn't bother to raise his rifle. I wanted to look at the ape again. In the middle of the night? You'll see more tomorrow morning when it's light. I couldn't sleep, and I'll be returning to Colombo tomorrow. He walked up next to the monster. When did the ape first appear?
Blackout of 65 in New York City, said the seated man. Showed up in the middle of Manhattan. Nobody knows where it came from, though. Probably has something to do with the wild card. At least, that's what people say.
Jaiwathana nodded. I'm going to walk around to the other side, to look at his face.
Just don't put your head in its mouth.
The guard flicked his cigarette butt onto the ground. Jaiwathana crushed it out with his shoe as he walked past. The ape's breath was hot, organic, but not foul. Jaiwathana waited, hoping that the beast would open its eyes again. The vision had told him what was behind them, but he wanted another look. The dreams had never been wrong before, but his reputation would be destroyed if he went to the authorities with this story and it proved wrong. And there would be questions about how he could have known. He would have to answer them without revealing his unusual abilities. Not an easy problem to solve in so little time. The ape's eyes stayed shut. The jungle's night sounds were more distant than usual. The animals were staying far away from the camp. Jaiwathana hoped it was because they sensed the ape, sensed the wrongness about it. He glanced at his watch. It would be dawn in a couple of hours. He would speak to Danforth first thing in the morning, then go back to Colombo. Dr. Tachyon had the reputation of being able to work wonders. It would be his task to transform the ape. The vision made that very clear. Perhaps the alien could even help him, if his pilgrimage failed. He walked back to his tent and spent the next few hours praying to the Buddha for a little less enlightenment. It was past 9 o'clock when Danforth emerged, bleary-eyed, from the main portable building. Jaiwathana was on his second cup of tea but was still moving slowly, as if his body were encased in mud. Mr. Danforth, I must speak to you before leaving this morning. Danforth yawned and nodded. Fine. Look, before you get away, I want to take some pictures. You know, the entire crew and the ape. Something to give to the wire services. I'd appreciate it if you'd be in it, too. Danforth yawned again even wider. God, gotta get some coffee in me. The boys are supposed to have everything set up by now. I'll be free for a few minutes after that, and we can talk about it then.
I think it would be best to discuss it now, privately. He looked out into the jungle. Perhaps take a walk away from the camp?
In the jungle? I heard they killed a cobra yesterday. No way.
Danforth backed away. I'll talk to you after we get our publicity shots done. Not before.
Jaiwardena took another sip of tea and walked over to the truck. He wasn't surprised or disgusted at Danforth's attitude. The man had the weight of a multi-million-dollar project on his shoulders. That kind of pressure could skew anyone's values, make him fear the wrong things. Most of the crew were already assembled in front of the giant ape. Paula was sitting in front, chewing on her fingernails while looking over the production schedule. He knelt down next to her.
I see His Majesty hooked you into doing this just like the rest of us, Paula said without looking up.
I'm afraid so. You don't look like you slept very well.
It's not that I didn't sleep well. I didn't sleep, period.
I was up with Roger and Mr. D all last night, but it comes with the territory. She leaned her head back and rotated it in a slow, circular motion. Well, as soon as Roger, Robin, and the boss get here, we can get this fun over with.
Jaiwardena downed the rest of his tea. Later in the day, a busload of extras, most Sinhalese with a few Tamils and Muslims, was scheduled to arrive. Although selected to be in the film spoke English, which was not uncommon given the island's history of British involvement. Danforth showed up with Roger in tow. The producer looked at the group and squinted.
The ape's facing the wrong way. Somebody get that truck turned around.
A gray-clad guard waved, jumped up into the cab, and started the truck up.
Okay, everybody out of the way so we can get this done quickly.
Danforth motioned them toward him. Somebody whistled and Jaiwardena turned. Robin was walking toward the group. She was wearing a long, skin-tight silver dress. She wasn't smiling.
Why do I have to wear this now? It's going to be bad enough during shooting. I'll probably get a heat stroke.
Robin put her hands on her hips and frowned.
Danforth shrugged. Jungler shooting is a pain in the butt. You knew that when you took the part.
Robin pressed her lips tightly together and was quiet.
The truck backed into position and Danforth clapped his hands. All right, everybody back where you were before. We'll get this over as quickly as possible.
One of the guards walked over to Danforth. Jaiwardena moved in close enough to hear.
I think we woke it up when we moved the truck, sir. Want me to dope him up again before you take your pictures?
No, it'll look better if there's a little life in the damn thing,
Danforth stroked his chin,
and feed it when we're done. Then you can knock it out again.
Right, sir.
Jaiwardena took his place in front of the truck. The ape's breathing was irregular. He turned. The ape's eyes fluttered and opened. Its pupils were dilated. The eyes moved about slowly, looked at the cameras, and stopped at Robin. They became bright and purposeful. Jaiwardena felt his skin go cold. The ape took a deep breath and roared, a sound like 100 lions. Jaiwardena started to run, but tripped over somebody who'd reacted away from the ape and into him. The ape was rocking back and forth on the truck. One of the tires blew out. The monster continued to roar and pull at the chains. Jaiwardena struggled to his feet. He heard the high-pitched squeal of metal straining against metal, then a loud pinging noise as the chain snapped. Steel shrapnel from the broken chains flew in all directions. One piece hit a guard. The man fell screaming. Jaiwardena ran to the man and helped him to his feet. The ground was shaking right behind them. He turned to look back, but the ape was already past them. Jaiwardena turned to the injured man.
Broken rib, I think, maybe two, said the guard through gritted teeth. I'll be okay.
A woman screamed. Jaiwardena left the man and rushed ahead. He could see most of the ape over the tin tops of the portable buildings. It bent down and picked up something in its right hand. It was Robin. He heard a gunshot and tried to move faster. His sides ached already. The ape snatched up a tent and threw it at one of the guards, whose rifle was raised for another shot. The canvas drifted down over the man, spoiling his aim.
No, no, Jaiwardena yelled. You might hit the woman.
The monster looked over the camp briefly, then waved its free arm disdainfully at the humans and shouldered into the jungle. Robin Sims was limp and pale against the huge darkness of its chest. Danforth sat on the ground, head in hands. Oh, shit. What the hell do we do now? This wasn't supposed to happen. Those chains were made of titanium steel. It can't be happening. Jaiwardena put his hand on the producer's shoulder. Mr. Danforth, I'll need your fastest car and your best driver. And it might be better if you came along with us. Danforth looked up. Where are we going? Back to Colombo. A group of your aces is arriving there in a few hours. He smiled thinly. Long ago, our island was called Serendip, the land of fortunate coincidence. Thank God, there's a chance then. He stood up, the color returning to his face. I'll get things moving. Need any help? Paula dabbed at a cut over her eye with her shirt sleeve. Only all I can get, Danforth said. The ape roared again. It already seemed impossibly far away. The car sped along down the road, jolting them at every bump and pothole. There were still a few miles outside Ratnapura. Jayawardena was in the front seat, directing the driver. Paula and Danforth sat silently in the back. As they rounded a corner, he saw several saffron-robed Buddhist priests ahead. Stop! He yelled as the driver braked the car. They went into a skid and off the road, sliding to a stop. The priests, who had been working on the dirt road with shovels, stood to one side and motioned them through. Who are they? Asked Paula. Priests. Members of an appropriate technologist group, Jaiwardena said as the driver pulled back onto the road. He bowed to the priests as he went past. Much of their time is spent doing such work. He planned to call ahead from Ratnapura, let the government know the situation and discourage the military from attacking the creature. That would be difficult, given the amount of damage it could cause. Tachyon and the aces would be the answer. They had to be. His stomach burned. It was dangerous to hinge his plans on people he'd never met, but he had no other choice. I wonder what set him off, Danforth asked, his voice almost too soft to hear. Well, Jaiwardena turned to speak to them. He looked at the cameras, then at Miss Sims. It was as if something clicked in his brain, brought him right out of the stupor. If anything happens to her, it'll be my fault. Danforth looked at the muddy floorboard. My fault. Then we'll all have to work hard to make sure nothing does happen to her, Paula said. Okay? Right, Danforth said weakly. Remember, she said, patting his shoulder, it's beauty that kills the beast, not the other way around. Hopefully we can resolve the situation and keep both beauty and beast alive. Jaiwardena turned to look back at the road. He spotted the buildings of Ratnapura ahead. Slow down when you get to town. I'll direct you where we need to go. He intended to inform the military of the situation and then return to Colombo. Jaiwardena sank back into the car seat. He wished he had slept better the night before. Today's work was going to spill into tomorrow and maybe even the next day. They arrived back in Colombo a little after noon and went directly to Jaiwardena's home. It was a large white stucco residence with a red-tiled roof. Even when his wife had been alive, it had been more space than they needed. Now he rattled around in it like a coconut in an empty boxcar. He called his office and found out the American delegation of aces had arrived and was staying at the Galadari Meridian Hotel. After settling Danforth and Paula in, he went to his garden shrine and reaffirmed his pledge of the five precepts. Afterward, he hurriedly put on a clean white shirt and a pair of pants and ate a few fingerfuls of cold rice. Where are you going now? Paula asked as he opened the door to leave. To speak to Dr. Tachyon and the Americans about the ape. He shook his head as she got up off the couch. It would be better for you to rest now. Whatever develops, I'll call you. Okay. Is it all right if we get something to eat? Danforth already had the refrigerator door open. Certainly. Help yourselves. Traffic was heavy, even on the sea beach road, which Jaiwardena had instructed the driver to take. The car's air conditioner was broken and his clean clothes were soaked with sweat before they were even halfway to the hotel. The film company driver, his name was Saul, was slowing to stop in front of the Galadari Meridian when the engine died. He turned the key several times, but there was only a clicking sound. Look, Jaiwadhana pointed toward the hotel entrance. People were scattering around the main doorway as something rose into the air. Jaiwadhana shaded his eyes as they flew over. One was a full-grown Indian elephant, a common enough sight, but this one was flying. Seated on its back was a well-muscled man. The elephant's ears were extended and appeared to help the creature steer while flying. "Elephant girl," said Saul. Crowds stopped up and down the street, pointing in silence as the aces flew by overhead. "Do what you can with the car," he told Saul, who already had the hood up. Jaiwadhana walked quickly to the hotel's main entrance. He pushed past the doorman, who was sitting on the sidewalk, shaking his head, and into the darkness inside. Hotel employees were busy lighting candles and reassuring the guests in the bar and restaurant.
"Waiter, get those drinks over here," the male voice came from the bar. He spoke English with an American accent.
Jaiwadhana let his eyes adjust to the dim lighting, then made his way carefully into the bar. The bartender was setting lamps up next to the mirror behind the bar. Jaiwadhana pulled out his handkerchief and wiped his sweaty forehead. They were seated together in a booth. There was a large man with a dark, spade-shaped beard, wearing a tailored blue three-piece suit. Across from him was another man. He was middle-aged, but trim, and sat in the booth as if it were a throne. Although he thought he knew the men, the woman sitting between them was instantly recognizable. She was wearing a low-cut, shoulderless black dress trimmed with sequins. Her skin was transparent. He quickly looked away from her. Her bone and muscles reflected the light in a disturbing manner.
"Pardon me," he said, walking over to them. "My name is Jaiwadhana. I'm with the Department of the Interior."
"And what do you want?" The large man took a skewered cherry from his drink and rolled it between his manicured thumb and forefinger. The other man stood, smiled, and shook Jaiwadhana's hand. The gesture was studied, a political greeting refined by years of practice. "I'm Senator Greg Hartman. Pleased to meet you."
"Thank you, Senator. I hope your shoulder is better."
Jaiwadhana had read about the incident in the newspapers.
"It wasn't as bad as the press made it sound." Hartman looked at the other end of the booth.
"The man torturing that cherry is Hiram Worcester, and the lady is
Chrysalis, I believe," Jaiwadhana bowed. "May I join you?"
"Certainly," Hartman said. "Is there something we can do for you?"
Jaiwadhana sat down next to Hiram, whose bulk partially obscured Chrysalis. He found her profoundly disturbing to look at.
"Several things, perhaps. Where were Elephant Girl and that man going just now?"
"To catch the ape, of course." Hiram looked at him as one might at an embarrassing relative, "and rescue the girl. We just found out about it. Catching the beast is something of a tradition," he paused, "for aces."
"Is that possible? I don't think Elephant Girl and one man can manage that."
Jaiwadhana turned to Hartman.
"The man with her was Jack Braun," Chrysalis said. Her accent was more British than American.
"Golden boy. He can handle almost anything, up to and including the giant ape. Although he hasn't been getting his rest lately. His glow's been a little on the feeble side." She nudged Hiram.
"Don't you think?"
"Personally, I don't really care what happens to Mr. Braun." Hiram twirled a small, red plastic sword from his drink. "And I think the feeling's mutual."
Hartman coughed. "At the very least, they should be able to rescue the actress. That should simplify matters for your government."
"Yes, one would hope." Jaiwadhana folded and unfolded a cloth napkin. "But such a rescue should be carefully planned out."
"Yes, they did rather fly off the handle," Chrysalis said, taking a sip of brandy.
Jaiwadhana thought he caught a glint of mischief in Hartman's eyes, but dismissed it as the lighting.
"Could you tell me where to find Dr. Tachyon?"
Hiram and Chrysalis both laughed. Hartman maintained his poise and gave them a disapproving look.
"He's unavailable right now."
Chrysalis motioned to the waiter and pointed to her glass.
"Which one of the stewardesses is he trying this time?"
"Upstairs, trapped in the darkness together. If anything will help Taki get over his problem, this is it. The doctor's not to be disturbed right now."
Hiram held the plastic sword above the table and made a fist with his other hand. The sword fell and stuck in the tabletop.
"Get the point. Could we give him a message for you?"
Hartman asked, ignoring Hiram. Jaiwadana pulled out his snakeskin wallet and handed Hartman one of his business cards.
Please, have him contact me as soon as possible. I may be busy the rest of the afternoon, but he can reach me at my home. It's the bottom number.
I'll do what I can, Hartman said, standing to shake hands again. I hope we see you again before we leave.
Nice meeting you, Mr. Jaiwadana, Chrysalis said. He thought perhaps she was smiling, but couldn't be sure.
Jaiwadana turned to leave, but stopped short as two people entered the bar. One was a man whom Jaiwadana judged to be in his late 30s. He was tall and muscular, with blonde hair, and a camera slung over his shoulder. The woman with him was as stunningly beautiful as any of the photographs Jaiwadana had seen of her. Even without the wings, she would have attracted attention. Peregrine was a vision he would willingly linger on. Jaiwadana stepped out of their way as they joined the others in the booth. They were still lighting candles and lamps in the lobby when he left. It was hard to arrange for a helicopter with the ape on the loose, but the base commander owed him more than one favor. The pilot, headgear under his arm, was waiting for Jaiwadana at the chopper. He was dark-skinned, a Tamil, part of the military's new plan to try to integrate the armed forces. The aircraft itself was a large, outdated model, lacking the sleek aerodynamics of the newer attack ships. Olive paint was peeling from the chopper's metal skin and the tires were balding. Jaiwadana nodded to the pilot and spoke to him in Tamil. I had requested a bullhorn be put on board.
Already done, sir.
The pilot opened the door and crawled up into the cockpit. Jaiwadana followed. The young Tamil was going through a checklist, flipping switches, examining gauges.
I've never been in a helicopter before, Jaiwadana said, buckling his seatbelt.
He pulled against the belt, testing it, not exactly happy that it was fraying around the edges. The pilot shrugged and put on his helmet, then cranked the engine, took the stick, and engaged the rotor. The blades whopped noisily, and the helicopter lifted slowly into the sky.
Where are we going, sir?
Let's head down to Ratnapura and Adam's Peak, he coughed. We'll be looking for a man on a flying elephant. American aces.
Do you want to engage them, sir?
The pilot's tone was cool and professional.
No, nothing like that.
Just observe them. They're after the ape that escaped. The pilot took a deep breath and nodded, then flipped on the radio and picked up the mouthpiece.
Line base, this is Shadow One. Can you give us any information on a flying elephant? Over.
There was a pause and a crackle of static before the base answered.
Your target reported heading due east from Colombo, approximate speed 150 kilometers per hour. Over.
Acknowledged. Over and out. The pilot checked his compass and adjusted his course.
Hopefully we can find them before they locate the ape. I don't think they have any real idea where to look, but the country isn't that large.
Jaiwadana pointed to dark clouds ahead. As he did, there was a flash of lightning.
Are we safe from bad weather?
Fairly safe.
Do you think these Americans would be stupid enough to fly into a storm?
He pointed the chopper toward a thin spot in the wall of clouds.
Hard to say. I don't know these people. They've handled the creature before, though.
Jaiwadana looked down. The land beneath was rising steadily upward. The jungle was broken here and there with tea and rice fields or water reservoirs. From the air, the flooded rice paddies looked like the shards of a broken mirror, the pieces reassembled so that they almost touched each other.
Something ahead, sir.
The pilot reached under his seat and handed over a pair of binoculars. Jaiwadana took them, wiped off the lenses with the tail of his shirt, and looked in the direction the pilot was pointing.
There was something. He rotated the adjusting knob and brought it into focus. The man on the elephant was pointing toward the ground.
It's them, Jaiwadana said, setting the binoculars on his lap.
Get in close enough for this to be heard. He raised the bullhorn.
Yes, sir.
Jaiwadana's mouth and throat were dry. He opened his window as they got closer in. The aces didn't seem to have noticed them yet. He switched on the bullhorn and set the volume control near the top. He saw the ape's shoulders and head above the treetops and knew why the Americans were paying no attention to the helicopter. He stuck the bullhorn out the window as the chopper moved in.
Elephant girl? Mr. Braun?
Jaiwadana thought Golden Boy was inappropriate for a grown man.
My name is Jaiwadana. I'm an official with the Sri Lankan government. Do you understand what I am saying?
He spoke each word slowly and carefully. The bullhorn vibrated in his sweaty hand. Jack Braun waved and nodded. The monster had stopped to look up and bare its teeth. It stripped the foliage off the top of a tree and set Robin in a crook between two bare branches.
"Rescue the woman if you can, but do not harm the ape."
Jaiwadna's voice sounded almost unintelligible from inside the helicopter, but Braun made a thumbs-up signal to show he understood.
"We'll stand by," Jaiwadna said.
The ape reached down, scooped up a handful of dirt, and crushed the contents down with its palms. The creature roared and threw the dirt ball at the aces. The flying elephant dropped out of its path. The missile continued upward. Jaiwadna saw it was going to hit the chopper and gripped the seat as tightly as possible. The earth thudded against the side of the aircraft. The helicopter began to spin, but the pilot quickly brought it back under control and pulled up sharply.
"Better keep a safe distance," the pilot said, making sure the ape stayed in view. "If the momentum hadn't been spent on that, I don't think we'd still be in the air."
"Right," Jaiwadna slowly exhaled and wiped his brow. A few scattered raindrops began to dot the windshield. The elephant girl had moved about 50 yards away from the ape and down to treetop level. Braun jumped off her and disappeared into the undergrowth. The elephant gained height again and trumpeted, moving back toward the monster. The ape snarled and beat its chest, the sound like an explosion underground. The standoff lasted a minute or two, then the ape rocked backward, catching its balance just at the point of falling over. Elephant girl swooped down quickly toward the woman in the tree. The ape swung his arms at her. The flying elephant banked away, wobbling a bit.
"Did it hit her?"
Jaiwadna turned to the pilot. "Should we move in and try to help?"
"I don't think there's much we can do. Possibly distracted, but that could get us knocked down."
The pilot put the stick between his knees and wiped the sweat from his palms. The ape roared and reached down to pick up something. Jack Braun struggled in the creature's hand, trying to push the giant fingers open. The ape lifted him up to its open mouth.
"No,"
Jaiwadna said, turning his head away. The beast roared again, and Jaiwadna looked back. The monster rubbed its mouth with its free hand. Braun, apparently unhurt, was bracing his back against the ape's fingers and pushing the thumb open. The monster flipped its arm like a baseball pitcher, sending Braun cartwheeling through the air. He came down in heavy jungle several seconds and several hundred yards away. The Tamil sat with his mouth slightly open, then put the helicopter into a turn toward the spot where Braun had disappeared into the trees.
"It tried to eat him, but he wouldn't go down. I think he broke one of the devil's teeth."
The elephant girl followed behind them. The ape picked Robin out of the tree, and after a final triumphant roar, began wading through the jungle again. Jaiwadna bit his lip and looked at the treetops for broken limbs to show where Braun had fallen through. The rain grew heavier, and the pilot switched on the wipers.
"There he is,"
the Tamil said, slowing to a hover. Braun was climbing up a large coconut palm tree. His clothes were in tatters, but he didn't appear hurt. Elephant girl moved in, curled her trunk around his waist, and lifted him onto her back. Braun bent over and held onto her ears.
"Follow us," Jaiwadna said, using the bullhorn again. "We'll lead you back to the airbase. Are you all right, Mr. Braun?"
The golden ace made a thumbs up again, this time without looking at them. Jaiwadna said nothing for several minutes. Perhaps his vision had been wrong. The beast appeared so vicious. A normal person would have been crushed to a paste between the monster's teeth. No, the dream had to be true. He couldn't allow any self-doubt, or the ape would have no chance at all. They outraced the storm back to Colombo.